happened to talk about Grover algorithm. So the last talk was about a very, very impressive result, because it's one of the first very impressive results that we got in quantum computation, which means that we have this problem, basically factoring, which can be solved exponentially faster on a quantum computer than on a classical computer, at least with the best currently known algorithm. Okay? And this exponential gap is very important. For example, if you want to factor, let's say, 500 or 600-digit numbers, and you use a classical computer, it will take you a time which is comparable to the age of the universe. And if you have a quantum computer, even a quantum computer with not a very fast clock speed, still, you can do it in a very reasonable time, like a few seconds or a few minutes, okay? Depending, of course, on the clock speed. We don't have a quantum computer right now, so I don't know if it will be possible to build one with a very fast clock speed. But this gap is huge, so this is a very, very important result. The thing is, what about the practical application? Well, if the NSA can get a quantum computer, they would be very happy, because they would be able to break most of the cryptography that is currently used on the Internet. So this is very useful. But the thing is, if we ever get quantum laptop, if everybody is having his own private quantum computer, the thing is that everybody will be able to break these codes. So it will not be necessarily useful to use these codes anymore. So nobody will have any number to factor. Okay? So that's the thing. So what I'm going to talk about today is another algorithm which has been introduced by Grover, and I'm going to talk about the way some researchers have analyzed this algorithm and completed it. And the thing is that it's less impressive in one sense. It's less impressive because the gap between the best-known classical algorithm and the best-known quantum algorithm is not exponential. But still, we know that we can solve a very important problem on the quantum computer faster than on the classical computer. And the thing is that this problem is very, very important. And I think even though it is less impressive about the efficiency, it's still very impressive about the usefulness of this algorithm. So I'm going to talk about this problem in detail. There is much more detail on my slide than that what can be absorbed in 1 hour. So my slides have been printed in this booklet, so you can have them as a reference. But I might go fast with some of the mathematical detail, and then you can look afterward to see how it goes. So I'm going to talk about Grover algorithm. I'm going to define the problem. I'm going to sketch some application without any detail. I'm going to very much insist on the main result, which is Grover algorithm. So first, I have to do some complexity theory a little bit. So some of you are computer scientists. They already know about the class NP. The class NP is probably the most important complexity class in computer science, in some sense, because lots of problems are in this class. Lots of interesting problems are in this class. And this is a class of hard problem. So the thing is, here is a formal definition of the class NP. And then I will give you some example of problems which are in this class. And this is the kind of problem that we want to attack with the quantum computer. So we say that a problem, or formally a set, is in NP if there is a polynomial time algorithm F such that if W is in the set, so if you have an element of the set, then there is a witness or a short proof X such that if you apply the polynomial time algorithm on this proof, it will output 1. And if W is not in the set, then whatever the proof you try, whatever the short string X you try, you will never get an output of f of x is equal to 1. So the thing is, this class, NP, is the class of problem which might be very hard to solve, but which are very easy to verify once you have the solution. Okay, and lots of problems are like that. And for those who know a little bit about complexity, of course, we have the class of NP-complete problem. And what is very nice with this complexity class is that there is hundreds of problems which are exactly equivalent. What do I mean by equivalent? Well, I mean if you can solve one of them efficiently, then you can solve all of them efficiently. So this class of NP-complete problem is very interesting. So let's give some example of problem in the class NP, And especially the problem I'm going to give are complete, which means that if you have a nice ID to solve one of these problems, then you're going to get rich and famous because you're going to be able to solve all of these problems, and they are very useful. So the first problem is scheduling. So I'm not going to go into detail. I just want to give you some intuition about the kind of problem we can solve. So scheduling is the following thing. We have a set of constraints. So for example, a schedule for an exam for the student at the end of a term. So the constraints are, for example, that you don't want to have a student which has two exams at the same time. Okay? And you can have other constraints. And it's easy to verify if you give me a schedule. It's easy to verify if I satisfy the constraint or not. So there is a polynomial time algorithm given a schedule that says, is this schedule appropriate? But the thing is, as you might know, this is a hard problem to find a good schedule. Okay, so this is a problem that is in NP, and it is complete. Another problem, which is very interesting, is the traveler salesman. So this problem is, suppose you have, let's say, a rock band or a scientist or somebody that has to travel in different cities. A bunch of different cities. So the example of the rock band is interesting because it's very expensive to move from one city to the other because you have to move all the equipment and everything and you have to take the airplane. So if you want to do a tour and visit all a bunch of cities, the thing is it possible to do it given the cost between the transportation between each pair of city? Is it possible to do it within a fixed budget? And the thing, of course, if you go to Europe and then to Canada and then to United States and then to Europe and then if you move like that, it will be very inefficient. It will cost a lot and you will bust your budget. But the thing is, if you give me a schedule, if you give me a list of the city that you're going to take and which order, then I can verify efficiently that this meets the budget. So, and another example is the KNACKSA problem. So, well, let's move on to the satisfiability problem. So there is lots of example of NP problem, and one of the famous one is the TreeSAT problem, or the satisfiability problem. So it's very interesting because it's very formal. So you have an expression, so you have a Boolean expression. So it's a special kind of circuit. So this expression, this Boolean expression, you want to find a set of value of the variable such that the function evaluates to 1, okay? And, of course, there is a lot of choice for a Boolean variable. If you have n variable, there is 2 to the n Boolean choice. And if you want to be sure that there is no solution, or if you want to try to find one solution and there's only one, then you have to try a lot of different Boolean value. So, namely, 2 to the n, which is take a very long time if n is even small and take a lot of time. The thing is that this problem was the first one to be shown to be complete. The thing is that you can understand why this problem is complete if you think a little bit about it, because every other problem that I was talking about can be set in this thing of circuit constraint. So this problem on the classical computer, unfortunately, we have no good algorithm to solve this problem. We have no good algorithm to solve any of these problems. The only thing we can prove is basically that, with the best algorithm we have, it will take an exponential time because the space of all the possible candidates is so huge that you have to check all these candidates to find a good one, and it takes lots of time. Of course, we have some heuristics. But even if the heuristics are much more efficient than brute force search, they still have an exponential behavior. And the bad thing with these heuristics is that we cannot prove anything about them. They just work fine in practice. So the title of my talk is Groover Algorithm, because Groover came up with the sketch of a solution. So Groover has studied a similar problem, and Groover gave some quantum operation that you can do to help you to solve this problem, but it didn't give a complete solution. So other scientists have worked, I will give you some reference at the end, other people have worked in order to get an algorithm. So the way Groover presented this algorithm, you will not be surprised, it looked like this black box things, okay? So you have a database or a black box, and this is a table T. And you're given an entry Y, and the database is not sorted. So all these entries are in different random order. And you want to find an indices I such that T of I is equal to Y. Well, classically, in this black box model, this is a black box because you just have a table that you can look up. Well, trivially, classically, if you want to find such a Y, you're going to have to go through all the tables. But so there is no hope on having a classical algorithm which will be efficient to solve this problem stated like that. But the thing is that it's worthwhile to state a problem in a formal way like that in a black box model, because quantumly, if we have access to a black box to evaluate query this database, then I'm going to give you an efficient algorithm. But I prefer to phrase it in terms of function, because previously I was talking about function. I prefer to phrase it in terms of function because I think it gives more insight. So suppose you have a Boolean function, a function that goes from a set X. X is a large set. Okay? X, there's a lot of candidates. And this function has value 0 or 1. Okay? And you want to find an X such that f of x is equal to 1. And the thing is that you're given the circuit to evaluate f. But you look at the circuit and you have no clue. You don't know how to analyze the circuit in order to find an x such that f of x is 1. The only thing you can do classically is, well, let's guess some x. So this function is going to be a black box because classically we don't know how to use it, how to use the structure of this black box. And quantumly, we don't need to use the structure of the black box. So this is why it's convenient to have a black box. And the thing is that if you can solve this problem of finding an X given a circuit such that f of x is equal to 1, you can solve every NP-complete problem efficiently, if you can solve that efficiently. Or if you can have a more efficient algorithm than the classical algorithm, then we're happy, even though it's not an exponential gap. As you will see, it will be a polynomial gap between the two. So now let's do some quantum mechanics. Let's do some quantum algorithm. The thing with Groover algorithm, the algorithm proposed by Groover, one of the good things about this algorithm is that it's quite simple. It involves a few unitary transformations that you do, and we call this set of unitary transformation the Groover iterate, because basically what the algorithms do is that it implements this iterate a lot of time, many times, and at the end you do a measurement and you're happy. We'll see why. Actually, in this slide, you have the Groover iterate explained in detail. So the Groover iterate, of course, here is composed of three different unitary transformations. First you do SF, then you do H, then you do S0, then you do H again. H is the Hadamard transform that you have already seen applied to every bit of the quantum register. What is SF? Well, if you want to find an X such that f of x is equal to 1, at some point, you will have to query the black box f, okay? And the thing is that the transformation SF is the transformation that queries the black box. So if you have a circuit, you can have a quantum circuit to evaluate f, so you can implement the evaluation of this circuit on a quantum computer, and you can implement SF. And SF, for convenient reason, we don't want to have the answer is I such that f of I is equal to 1. We don't want to have the bit. We want to have this information in the phases. So what we have seen some trick to do this thing. So using only one bit, one more qubit in the state 0 minus 1, you can do such a transformation efficiently given a black box that gives you the binary value. So the thing is that SF on basis vector, so we just have to define what SF does on classical basis state. So what it does is that if f of I, well, S applied to I, is if f of I is equal to 1, then it switches the phase. It negates the phase. And if f of I is equal to 0, then it doesn't switch the phase. And in order to implement this unitary transformation, you have to do only one query to the circuit that evaluates f. So in one Groover iteration, there is only one query to the database or to the function that evaluates f. The thing is that we also need, like I said, the Adamard transform, and here you have a definition of the Adamard transform on basis state. This is a 1-2-bit easy operation to implement. And of course, if you apply it n time into a quantum register, then you have already seen that we obtain the following state. So basically, if you apply the Adamard transform to a base state, you always obtain a superposition of every possible state, but with different phases, okay? And the phases is dependent on which state you apply to it. And in particular, if you apply the Adamard transform to the state 0, 0, 0, then you get an equal superposition of all possible base state. And this is very convenient. So this is the Grover iterate. So now, let's talk about what Grover did is to give Grover algorithm, which is the following. Yes?
Why the minus sign?
The minus sign is just, it's not necessary. It's just for, it's just nicer in the mathematics, because otherwise you switch the sign of all the amplitudes. So don't bother about the minus sign. It's just for, I would say, historical reasons. It doesn't change anything, actually. So the thing is, what is Grover algorithm? Well, Grover algorithm takes the function f as an input. Grover algorithm is not going to analyze the function f. Grover algorithm is just going to evaluate the function f. And Grover algorithm takes an integer m, which is the number of Grover iteration that will be done. So the thing is that you start with a state psi, which is apply Adamard to 0. And like I told you, if you apply Adamard to 0, you get an equal superposition of every basis state. So once you have the superposition, suppose you decide to measure just right now. So you decide to measure your system after 0 iteration. You're not even querying the database once. What are you going to obtain? Well, you have an equal superposition of all possible candidates. So you will see with equal probability one of these candidates. And if there is only one good candidate, then you're very unlikely to see it. But still, the thing is that now we're going to do Grover iterate n times. And then something will happen to the amplitude of the good basis state, and something will happen to the amplitude of the bad basis state. And now we're going to measure. And the probability of seeing a good state, of seeing an x such that f of x is equal to 1, will be different. Because this Grover iteration has just been built in order to increase this probability. So here, n is, capital N is the size of the set X, which is basically the number of candidates that you have. And in the real world, this would be very large. And T is the number of solutions. So maybe you have 0 solution, maybe you have 1 solution, maybe you have a bunch of solutions. You don't know that in general. So now, I'm going to show you a graph which basically, in some way, will convince you. Suppose that this graph is some experimental data. Suppose I have a big quantum computer and I've done lots of experiments. And the thing is that what I've plot is, so what I've plot is what is the probability when I measure the register after m iteration. So this is the number of iteration that goes from 0 to 30. And here, capital N is 1024. So there is some candidate. And here, T for the first graph is equal to 1. So this graph is when T is equal to 1. And this graph is just the probability if I observe the register after M iteration to find by chance an X such that f of X is equal to 1. So first, if you do 0 iteration, then it's very unlikely, especially if t is equal to 1. So you have a very, very, very small probability. But if you do, let's say, 25 iteration, then this probability is very close to 1. Okay? And so the thing is, if you do lots of experiments with your quantum computer, you will see that this curve is highly dependent on the number of solutions. It turned out that the more solutions you have, of course, the more likely you are to see a solution. And also, the faster you will reach this point where you have a probability that is close to 1. Okay? So for example, if you have 2 solutions, then you have this graph here. If you have 4 solutions, then you have this graph here. So you only have to do, let's say, 13 iterations and not 25. Okay? So the thing is, what Groover did is to give this Groover iterate. And Groover said, well, if you promise me that there is only 1 solution, well, then we can show that, roughly speaking, the number of iteration, which would be optimal, is about the square root of n. Okay, so classically, you have to query the function roughly n times. Well, Groover sort of suggested that it's possible to do it with only square root of n, which is great, because at the speed where the computer are working right now, so it's like jiggered, so you can do, in one day, you can do a million of operations, okay? So the thing is, if you take the square root of such big number, then you have a big gain. You have a factor of a million, for example, for these things. So, but now we have to analyze this more carefully. We have to understand, because I don't want to have a promise first. I don't want to have the promise that there is only 1 solution, of course. I mean, I want to solve the search problem, and if I want to solve the traveler salesman problem, there are probably many solutions, and I don't know how many solutions there is, and they are to find, and I just want to find a solution. I don't want to have this promise. So the thing is, Groover algorithm is like a souffle. So who came up with this souffle? It's Chris Fuchs. Okay. So, yeah, the thing is, it's like a souffle, because the thing is, when you do the iteration, you don't make any measurement. You don't look at the state. You just do the iteration. And then at the end, you open the oven and you check, am I having a solution? So if you don't do enough iteration, then the souffle will not be good, of course, if you don't cook it enough. But if you cook it too much, as you can see, if I do 25 iterations and there is 4 solutions, I have almost zero probability of seeing an x such as f of x is 1. So this is why it's like a souffle. You have to do the right amount of iteration. Okay, so the analysis, I understand that most of you just learned about quantum information this week. So the analysis is going to be a little bit harsh, but I'm going to try to give the intuition, and of course you can look back at the slide later on to understand it in a better way. So, but the analysis is not so complicated that I have to lie. I'm going to tell you on my slide. I'm going to give you the formal analysis. Okay. So the thing is that I'm going to talk about non-normalized state here. So we have A, which is a superposition of all good states, all x such that f of x is equal to 1. I have b, which is a superposition of all x such that f of x is equal to 0. And of course, if you have a superposition of a and b, then you have a superposition of all possible candidates. Okay? The thing is that if you do the inner product between a and a, you obtain t, and between b and b, you obtain n minus t, because there is t good candidate and there is n minus t bad candidate. And the thing is that if you apply the Hadamard to the zero state, then you get an equal superposition of all states with amplitude 1 over square root of n, which means that basically if you observe this register, the probability of seeing any of these x is going to be 1 over n. So this is equal probability, but this is equal to the 1 over square root of n times a plus 1 over square root of n times b. And the thing is, Groover algorithm is very nice in a way. The thing is, you apply the algorithm, and the amplitude of the good state is this, of every good state is the same as the amplitude of every bad state. But the algorithm is going to move that a little bit. So the good state, the amplitude of the good state will increase, and the amplitude of the bad state will decrease, and it will go like that, and then it will cycle again. Okay? So the thing is that we can always write the state in which the quantum computer is as a linear combination of good state and bad state with the amplitude Km, okay? So depending on how many solutions there is, then the norm square of Km multiplied by the number of solutions gives you the success probability at any time. Okay, so this one is ugly. But everything is there, so you can have a look at this later on. So if we do the math in an appropriate way, if we look at what happened if you apply, so the minus sign is convenient when I do this calculation, but like I said earlier, it's not necessary to put the minus sign here. So the thing is that suppose that I have an equal superposition of good state and an equal superposition of bad state. Okay, so maybe the original state that we start with is like that. So the thing is that if you do all the computation line by line, what is happening when you apply the Groovitt iteration. So for example, I'm just give the first line. So for example, you apply S of S. What is S of S doing? Well, S of S is the part of the algorithm which is querying the function. And it's going to change the phase of every X such that F of X is equal to 1. So basically, it's going to transform this plus sign here into a minus sign here. Well, the minus sign should be in front of the K, but since there's a minus sign here, you can switch up the order, okay? So you can go line by line, and what you obtain is at the end, you have this big equation here. Well, what is this equation? Well, still, you have an equal superposition of all good states, equal amplitude of every good state, and equal amplitude of every bad state. But this amplitude now is different. The amplitudes depend on the K and the L, which in a strange way. And the thing is that is to analyze this and to prove by induction what is the solution of this linear equation. So the solution is on this slide. So what is the theorem? So for mathematical convenience, it's very convenient to define theta to be the solution of sine squared theta is equal to t over n. Remember that t is the number of good solution and n is the number of candidates. Okay, and the thing is, if you apply a Groover algorithm, so I have Groover algorithm to the m, so m time applying Groover algorithm to the initial state, which is the equal superposition of all state, then if you do this operation m times, you obtain the following state. So you obtain an equal superposition of all good state with all phase equal, all phase are real number, which are equal to km, and you also in your superposition you have bad state. But the phase, the amplitude of the bad state is Lm, and also Lm is a real number given by these two equations. So, of course, in the previous graph, you've seen that there's kind of a sine and cosine curve form. And this is why, because if you do the rigorous analysis, you can prove that by induction, then you see that the amplitude behaves like that. So basically, since it's the sine depends on what? Well, it depends, of course, on the number of iterations. But it also depends on theta, and theta is directly related to t. So this is why the number, the shape of the sine, so the number of period or the size of a period, is highly dependent on the number of solutions. And this is also going to be useful later on when I'm going to talk, if I have some time, on quantum counting. Okay, so a first result. When t is known, well, we have this equation. The amplitude is given of the good state is the sine of this equation. So basically, if we know t and we want to have an efficient algorithm, so if we know how many good candidates there is, then basically we just have to solve this equation to find the maximum here and set m, the number of iteration, to be the appropriate thing. And it turned out that the appropriate number of iteration is roughly square root of n over t. Okay, so if you know t, so there is there's a million candidates. There is 100 solutions. So there is n over t is 10,000. So the square root is 100. So that you have to do 100 iteration. Okay, which is again, I repeat, much smaller than what you would have to do classically. The thing is, unfortunately, with this result. Although, if you set m to be the right thing, you have a very good probability of success. So you don't have to repeat this algorithm many times, because even though your probability of success is not 1, it's pretty close to 1. But the bad thing is, well, I have no idea how many solutions there is, actually. So now I'm going to talk about what happens when t is unknown. I'm not going to go into detail on this algorithm. It's basically an easy trick that we do. So the thing is, I don't know the number of solutions. So what am I going to do? Well, let's go with a random number of iterations. Well, the problem is, of course, if I go with a random number of iterations, I might be lucky or unlucky because... So this is the curve that I don't know. And if I pick up, let's say, this number of iterations here, then I'm very unlucky. I'm not going to find it. So if I use a systematic way of deciding the number of iterations, then I might be always unlucky and always get here and then get here and then, you know. So the thing is to go slowly and to do it with a small number of iterations, which is random in this interval. And probably I'm not going to see a solution because here the probability is very small. And then I increase my interval, and then I try to find, I take a random number in this interval, and I do this number of iterations. And then I might be unlucky or lucky, and so on. And then probably the third time, when I will do it like that, I will pick up this number of iterations here at random, and then I'm very likely to find a solution. It looked naive and very... It looked naive and very inefficient. Yes, it's naive, but it's not very inefficient. Okay? The thing is, this is just exactly what we want, because this is the formal definition, a formal description of the algorithm I just showed you on the board. You can have a look at that if you want. But the thing is that the theorem is that if you apply this algorithm I just described, okay, and doing more and more iteration every time, then the expected number of iteration that you will do is in the order of square root of n over t, which is exactly the same thing as we had before. There's a big difference, though. Before, we knew that if we do this number of iteration, okay, we will have a very high probability of success. Here, this is the expected number, so it might be larger. Actually, I think the variance is quite high, but still, the expected number of iteration is very good, because even though we don't know t, we are going to do the same amount of work. So again, if t is very small, this is roughly square root of n, which is much more efficient than classically. So I'm going to show this slide for 5 seconds. Of course, one application is once you know how to search, there are many things you want to do, okay? And these are straightforward applications. You just have to work out the detail. If you can, for example, if you can find an x such that f of x is equal to 1, and your goal is not to find an x such that f of x is equal to 1, but to find the x such that f of x is minimal, well, then you can work out an algorithm, which is described here. And actually, the running time of this algorithm is also square root of n. So if you're interested, you can have a look. And of course, at the end, I will give you some reference where you can find paper that explains these results. Another one, which is a little bit less straightforward, but still a nice application of searching. This is the quantum algorithm I'm using here is searching, but I'm doing some it in a different way. So we'd like to find collision. So it's interesting, for example, in cryptography, in cryptology, to find collision, because we have in crypto these hash function, and they're supposed to be very hard. It's supposed to be very hard to find collision. The thing is, suppose I'm giving a simple example, a 2-to-1 function. So I have a function, and there is twice as much input as output. So for every output, there is a pair of input which give this output. I hope I'm clear with that. So there is lots of collision, actually, in this function. Well, classically, it might be very hard, even though there's lots of collision, there's lots of such pair which have a collision, but you don't know which one. So you try some candidate, and you try until you get a collision. And the thing is that because of the birthday paradox, it's possible to do it using square root of n query to your function. Of course, again, I'm making the assumption that when I look at the function, when I look at the description of the function, how to evaluate it, I have no clue. The only thing I can do is to evaluate it on a bunch of input. So because of the birthday paradox, if you query the function square root of n time, which requires square root of n space, then you're likely to get a collision. But the thing is that quantumly, we can do better. Quantumly, we can do it in the third root of n. which is more efficient, okay? And the thing is that we're going to massage the problem into a search problem. So first, I'm going to look at the first third root of n input of this function. Of course, I can already find a collision, and I'm happy, and then it's over, okay? So this is all classical. So I look at all the first square third root of n input, and then I make a table, and I sort them. So I have this table with a lot of evaluation of the function, but there is no collision yet, okay? And the thing is that to do that, I only have to do third root of n query to the function, okay? Of course, you can count the time for sorting, which is log n, but which had a log n factor, but the number of query will be third root of n. So I do that. And now what am I going to search for? Well, now I'm going to search for an x in the rest of the function such that there is a collision. And the thing is that the search space is going to be root 2 third of n, I think. And if you take the square root of that, then you have the third root. So again, if you apply searching to collision problem, then you can get this third root improvement. So I'm not going to talk about the optimality of Groove algorithm. What is very funny about this, well, the thing I'm going to say, actually, is that this Groove algorithm has been proved to be optimal in some model before it has been even invented. And Ronald De Wolf is going to talk about this model where you can prove that there is a lower bound on the running time of a quantum computer for solving this problem. So I'm not going to address this. So now there's two things I want to address, and I don't have much time, but still I'm going to do it the best I can. And one of these things is about heuristic, and the other thing is about counting. So, well, the thing is this square root improvement, the thing is the best classical known algorithm are exponential. They take an exponential time to solve these NP-hard problems. But the thing is that in practice, we have pretty good heuristics. It's very hard to prove anything about these heuristics, but in practice, they work well. Okay, if we look at the behavior of the heuristic, it's still exponential, but the exponential is smaller. It's not like 2 to the n. It's maybe like 1.01 to the n. Okay, so the thing is that these heuristics, in practice, give you a running time which might be smaller than the square root of searching all the possible candidates. So again, what I'm saying is that in practice, with heuristic, you might beat the quantum algorithm. Oh, well, maybe there's a problem, so maybe this algorithm is useless. No, not at all, because the thing is, if you give me such a heuristic for most of them, what I can do is that I can plug Groover on top of this heuristic and still get a square root improvement over the heuristic, even though I don't know how efficient the heuristic is. But what I know is if you program this heuristic on the quantum computer and you put Groover on top of the heuristic, then you still have a square root improvement over the classical algorithm, which is very important, I think, because I don't know exact number about the speed of these algorithms, but I know that in practice they work very well. And so it's very interesting that it's possible to implement this on the quantum computer. Again, I want to say that short factoring algorithm is very, very, very impressive and very important, and it was such an happening when we learned about this. But the thing is that Groove algorithm, although it's less efficient, still in practice might be of more interest, because there is so much problem like that we want to solve in practice. There's so much money involved that it might be worthwhile to construct the quantum computer. So, of course, we want the quantum computer to work on heuristics. So let me give you a very brief sketch of what I mean by a heuristic and what kind of heuristic I can improve. I can put Groover on top of it. So one heuristic that I know is called hill climbing. So you want to increase an objective function by doing some local modification. So let's give the example so you will understand. So suppose what I want to solve is this three-set problem. So I have this set of clauses. In each clause, there is exactly three variables, okay? And I want to take the end of every clauses. So I want to satisfy every clauses, but in the clauses we have an OR of the variable. Okay, so this is a very restricted form of a Boolean expression. Okay, and what is interesting with this very restricted form of Boolean expression is that it's NP-complete. So even this, if you can solve only this restricted form, well, you can solve all NP-complete problems. Okay, so the thing is that I'm going to start, well, one the brute force search would be to start, since I have four variables, would be to check the 16 value that they can have. So it's brute force and it's exponential in n, it's 2 to the n. The thing is that using hill climbing, I might be able to have a faster algorithm. So how it works is very easy. I start with a random assignment. So I pick the random assignment, x1 is equal to 1, x2 is equal to 1, x3 to 1, x4 to 1. And this assignment, of course, is not going to satisfy, it's very unlikely to satisfy all clauses. But it turned out that it satisfies 4 of the 6 clauses. Well, I'm going to try to maximize the number of clauses until I get to the point where I satisfy all of them. So the thing is that now on I'm going to use a deterministic algorithm. So the randomness in my algorithm is just the random choice that I do at the beginning. But now on I'm going to be systematic. And systematically, I'm going to twiggle every variable one after the other and look what's happened. So first, for example, if I change the value of x1 to be equal to 0, well, I'm lucky. This is the right choice because now I'm satisfying 5 clauses. Well, let's go on. Let's try to change the value of other variables to see if I can satisfy more clauses. And then if I modify the value of x2, then I can satisfy 6 clauses. So I'm done. I found the solution. Okay? And the thing is that this algorithm, in practice, is much more efficient than brute force, although to solve the tree set problem, it also has an exponential behavior, which means that for a very large problem, it's very, very difficult, but still it's much more efficient than the brute force search. So maybe you have an idea what I should do with my quantum computer. So the thing is that I would have to formalize, of course, what a heuristic is, but what's the thing in this heuristic? What am I looking for? I'm looking for, if I do brute force, I'm looking for an x such that f of x is equal to 1, and I'll go through all candidates. So this is brute force. If I do hill climbing, well, I'm taking a random assignment, and then I do a deterministic algorithm, and if everything goes well, I'm getting a solution. Well, so what am I looking for, actually? Well, I'm not looking for an x such that f of x is equal to 1. I'm looking for a random initialization such that my deterministic algorithm will lead me to a solution. So I'm also searching, actually, but I'm searching in a different space. I'm searching in the space of all the random string and not in the space of all the possible candidates, okay? Even though the candidate and the random string happen to be the same set in this example. So how to formalize a heuristic? Well, we have a family of function, a family of Boolean function, and a probability distribution over this function. And a heuristic takes as input one of the instances, one of these functions. So, for example, one of these tree set clauses, and a random number, a random integer, and it gives you an element of x. And if you're lucky, this element of x will be such that f of x is equal to 1, so you win. The thing is that to define a good heuristic, so in my slide it's more formal than what I'm going to say, but intuitively, what is a good heuristic? Well, what is the ratio of good x compared to n? So what is the ratio between t and n? So if there is a very, very small number of solutions and a very, very, very large number of candidates, then if I go at random and I try a solution, then I will be unlikely to find one. So we have some probability of success. Well, the thing is that I can do the same thing with the heuristic. I can look at the set of all possible random string, okay, and how many random string are good candidates, how many random string will end up giving me a solution. And the thing is that the heuristic is good is the ratio between the number of good random string and the total number of random string is larger than the ratio between the number of solution and the total number of candidates. Does it make sense? Yes? Okay. This is what's in the slide, even though I stated quite differently. So like I said, the solution to this problem is not to search for x such that f of x is equal to 1, but to search for a random string such that if I apply search, well, the thing is that I'm going to define this function g prime of f, g prime f of r, and basically what is this function? Well, first I apply the heuristic with the random string r over the function f, and this gives me an x, which might be such that f of x is equal to 1, and then I apply f. So the thing is that this function g prime is taking a random string and is outputting 1 if this random string is a good string, and it's outputting 0 if the random string is a bad string. By a good string, I mean that this random string is going to lead me deterministically to a good solution. And the thing is that what I'm going to do is that I'm going to apply search, the search algorithm, to this new function that I have constructed. So if I have a circuit if I have a description of the heuristic, then I can build a circuit for the heuristic, and then I can build a quantum circuit that for implementing the function f, and then I can apply Groover on that, and then I'm going to do search. And the thing is that if you do the analysis correctly, again, it's more formal in my slide than what I really want to say to you, but if you do the analysis rigorously, what you obtain is actually that the expected running time of your quantum algorithm that used the classical heuristic, is going to be exactly smaller or equal to the square root of the expected running time of the classical algorithm. So you still have the square root, which is very, very nice. So now I don't have much time to talk about counting, although counting is one of the interesting algorithms. So I'm just going to sketch. The thing is that in order to understand the quantum counting algorithm, it's a good idea to have a good understanding of the quantum Fourier transform. And I don't have many slides about the quantum Fourier transform, and I don't have much time. So I'm just going to try to give you the intuition. So at least I want you to understand what the problem is. So the first problem I described is to find a solution. Well, now this problem is very easy. It's to count the number of solutions. Okay? So of course, again, I'm in the model where when you give me the function, I look at it and I have no clue. The only thing I can really do is evaluate the function. And this is very realistic because in practice it's like that. For most functions, I cannot use the structure of the function, but I can evaluate it efficiently. So the thing is that classically, if I want to evaluate t, then I have to work a lot. Because, for example, if I want to have a very good estimate of t, so let's say that, again, capital N is the number of possible candidates, t is the number of solution, okay, and I want to evaluate t, so I have t tilde, which is a good estimate of t. And the thing is that if I want to have an estimate, which is, for example, the error is going to be roughly square root of t, so I have a very good estimate of t up to a square root, then if I want to do that classically, I will have to look at a constant fraction of the database, actually, if I want to do such an evaluation. I will have to look at a constant fraction of the database. Not all the database, but still a constant fraction. So it's going to be linear in the size of the database, linear in the size of the number of input to the function, actually. So it's a large number. The thing is that quantumly we can do it in square root of n. So this is quite a good improvement if you want to count the number of solutions. There is also this equation here. So if you want to have not an estimate which is not as good, so you're willing to have an estimate which is good up to an epsilon multiplicative constant, okay? So let's fix epsilon. This will simplify the equation. So if we fix the epsilon, what we see is that classically, in order to get this kind of approximation, you have to query the function or look at the database n divided by t times, in the order of n divided by t times, okay? And of course, it's also dependent on epsilon, but I fix epsilon. So, and then quantumly, again, if I fix epsilon, then the running time is proportional to the square root of n over t. So this is, again, we have this square root speed up. And finally, suppose I want to count exactly. Well, if I want to count exactly, classically, I have to look at all the database, and there's no other solution. If I want to have, let's say, 80% chances of counting exactly, then there's no way I can do that without looking at all the evaluation of the function. The thing is that quantumly, you can do a little bit better. It's not exactly the square root, but it's if you forget about this minus t here, it's roughly the square root of t multiplied by n, okay? The amount of work that you have to do. So you can count exactly without querying all the database. You just have, if t is small, you roughly have to query the database square root of n times. So how does it work? So basically, we found the algorithm for counting by the simple observation, this very nice observation, that the amplitude of the good state compared to m, the number of iteration, is just a periodic function. And this period, so I don't know if I can find my original slide. And so this period is highly dependent on the number of solutions. So if I can evaluate the period, then I will have some information about the number of solutions. And the better my approximation of the period size, the better my approximation of t. And more formally, we remember that k, the amplitude of the good state, is a sine function that depends on theta. And here again, theta is highly dependent on t. Okay, theta is dependent on the ratio of t over n. So this km is a periodic function of m. That period depends on theta, which means that the period depends on t. So if I can find a period of km, if I can find r, then I have lots of information about this t that I'm looking for. So here's all the quantum tools. So it's a little bit dense. I'm just using two quantum tools, actually. But these quantum tools are, even though they are efficient to implement on a quantum computer, they might not be trivial. So you already saw when Mike Muska was talking about doing a conditional iteration of something, doing a conditional transformation. So suppose I can do Grover. Believe me, even though I don't have any slide that proves that, believe me that you can do conditional iteration quantumly, okay, by using the trick that Mike Muska just said. So I have this transformation GI of F, which is basically taking two registers. The second register is just the working register of Grover. This is this register on which we apply Grover. This is the register that started in a superposition of all equal amplitude, and then that moves on, and that gives you more or less amplitude depending on the number of iterations. And the first register is actually the number of iterations. And the thing is that I'm going to do that quantumly, not classically. I'm going to do it coherently. So the thing is that if I apply it for a fixed m, which is a basis state, which is a classical state, then of course I'm applying just Grover algorithm. So I'm doing m times this iteration on the state psi. And if I measure psi, then I will have good or bad chance of seeing an output, an x such that f of x is 1. But the thing is that what I'm going to do actually is that I'm going to do it in superposition. So I'm going to initialize this register as an equal superposition of all number between 0 and p. So I will be in superposition of doing between 0 and p iteration at the same time. I'm going to have this nice superposition. And what I'm going to use to evaluate what is the period of this is the Fourier transform. So those of you who heard about the Fourier transform know that the Fourier transform usually is used when you have a periodic function and you want to find information about the period. So the thing is that the quantum Fourier transform is just basically doing the same thing, but over the coefficient. So you have this large superposition with an exponential number of different states, and you have all these coefficients, A1, A2, A3, A2. And the thing is that if you apply the quantum Fourier transform, then you're going to map this to another state, and the amplitude of all these states will be the Fourier coefficient of this transformation. So I'm not going to say more about a Fourier transform. The thing is that what you have to intuitively understand is that a Fourier transform is used to find a period, and this is exactly what we want to do. So once you have these tools, the quantum counting algorithm is very simple. First, you initialize your state. So you put 0 on the first register, which means do 0 iteration. And then you initialize the second register as being the initial state that you want to, when you want to do Grover iteration. Okay? So the initial state when you do Grover iteration is just apply Adamar to the 0 state, which will give you an equal superposition of all states. Then what you do is that you apply the Fourier transform on the first register. Why am I doing that? Well, I'm just applying the Fourier transform on the first register because the first register was in the state 0, and I want also to have an equal superposition of every possible state. So I want to have a superposition between the state 0 and up to the state P of all possible input, and I'm doing that by doing the Fourier transform. I've chosen the Fourier transform to have some symmetry here between these two operations. Then I'm doing Grover iterate. So first register is in the superposition of the number of time I want to do the iterate. The second register is in the state, the initial state of doing Grover iteration. So I'm going to do in superposition all of this, and I'm not going to look at the quantum register yet. I'm just doing this in superposition. And then I throw away the second register because the second register is not useful anymore. And I do the Fourier transform on the first register, and I'm going to find this period. And then I measure the first register, and then I output the appropriate function of what I've obtained. So I've obtained R tilde, which is an approximation of the number of periods. And if I multiply this by pi, divide by p, and take the sine square of that and multiply by n, then then I obtain t. But you already understood that t is related with the number of periods, and it's related with the number of periods with this specific equation here. So I have some slide that gives you all the detail of what the quantum state is after applying each of these operations. So if you look on the notes, you can see that you have a description of the quantum state after each operation, and you have some intuition, a little bit, some information about how it works, but I'm running out of time. So I think I'm going to conclude right now, and by saying that, I cannot stop right now. I have one more slide to show you. So the thing is that the counting theorem is the following theorem, is that if you do count, and if with the parameter p, so the larger p is, which means is the more possible number of iteration you will have. So if p is very large, then you will be in superposition of doing between 0 and p iteration, which means that you will be in superposition of doing between 0 and the last of iteration. The thing is that the estimate on t that you get is given by this equation. So this equation is dependent a lot on p, but it's also dependent on the number of solutions. So the thing is that with probability 8 over pi square, you will get such a good estimate. And using this thing with clever tricks, you can obtain the three results that I say to you. The three different quality of estimation that you want to obtain can all be obtained by using this theorem here. So it's important to give credit to the people who have done these works. So I have some reference about what I've told you and some of the stuff which is on my slide that I haven't told you about. So first, I think to be fair, the most important reference is the Grover. So Grover is the one who came up with this iteration, which is the iteration that we use to solve the searching problem. The thing is that after that, Boyer, Brassens, Hoyer, and myself have done some rigorous analysis, and we've shown that this iteration can be used even if you don't know the number of solutions and things like that. And we've also done some work on finding doing the counting algorithm. So we have also these reference for the minimum, for counting, and this last reference for amplitude amplification. So